struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes, Thursday in New York City. It is incredibly windy today. How are you? Mark Farrell right here. Always great to have you along. The tree went up last night. Well, it didn't go up last night. It was lit last night. Now it's lighted. It always sounds weird to say lighted tree. I like lit. Oh, like so many other things, I used to get lit in life. Anyway, thanks for so much for joining out with me. Incredible show. Two indomitable women you're going to meet today. First, you're going to meet Tara Pace. Actually, second, she's an incredible woman who conquered the runways worldwide and conquered everything that has happened to her. Incredible, incredible, resilient human being. Andrew Douglas is also artist, athlete, entrepreneur, and so much more. You're going to meet her momentarily. She is the author of Black and Blue, Sports, Love, and the Art of Empowerment. Touches on her life as a non-conforming female growing up in a conservative rural environment and her experience as an empowered executive and pioneer for women and American football. That's right, I said football. Wow, imagine that. So I have a sty in my eye, right? When's the last time you heard someone having a sty? Well, I got one. I don't know how I got it. Maybe from doing a lot of woodworking and some sawdust in the air, but we're not on Facebook Live today because I look like I did a few rounds with a pro boxer or played professional football with Andrew Douglas, who, by the way, was also a quarterback. Yes, incredible. Anyway, so we're not Facebook Live, so if you're searching for us on the our Facebook page, that is the reason why, because I'm not something you want to see today because one of my eyes closed and pussy and oozing. Anyway, cold day in New York City. Always love being in New York City in the wintertime. It just seems like it's, I don't know, has a an air of freshness to it versus the summertime. Always love your feedback. 888-874-4444. Andrew Douglas, as I mentioned, is an author, artist, athlete, entrepreneur, and most importantly, a New York City resident for 30 years. Andrew Douglas, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. Thank you.
I am just in complete awe to be in the company of you. You have conquered, accomplished, and set out so much in your life. And I imagine there's one word you don't like to, actually, maybe you do like to hear it because it actually propels you forward in life. The word no.
No, I don't want to hear no.
See? Yes, but it hasn't stopped you on any endeavor that you've embarked on.
No, and I think you're right because that it does propel me forward. It just, you know, no in my world is followed by why. So, and a lot of times, you know, the word no is fake news, as they say, because there's no reason for the word no. It's usually caused by fear. So mm-hmm. You go beyond, you know, look around the corner of no and you'll see that yes.
So you played football. You played football professionally. You owned a team. You were the quarterback of a team. And we're going to dive down into the specifics later on. But in your wildest dream as a youth, was that in that cloud over your head of dreams?
Well, it was, but not in the same sense. I mean, I didn't understand that I couldn't play on the Miami Dolphins, which was and still is my favorite NFL team.
My condolences, so, yeah, by the way.
Oh, God, I know.
Sorry.
Funeral. Yeah, I did have that cloud in my head, but never did I think it would turn out to be a women's league and myself as the owner and quarterback. It was just, I think it was better, quite honestly.
Fantastic. And when you were young, you did all kinds of sports. Your father was an outdoors person, loved nature, and hence how you became an artist later in life. But that's kind of how it set the platform, I guess, because you became someone who is an industrious person of all levels and all outlets in life, played multiple sports because you could not play football, correct? Rugby, semi-pro golfer?
That's correct, right? All because there was no football for girls.
Did that satisfy a lot of who you were as an athlete?
Well, you know, I had a great time. I met great people. I love competition. I love sports. So on one level, yes, but my passion was always football. So that was not fulfilled until, you know, later.
When you say your passion is always football, what is it in particular about football that drives you? And is there an underlying force that prevents you or prevented you from playing football that made you want it even more?
You know, I think I was best at football. Of all the sports I played when I was growing up as a kid, I was just best at football. You always gravitate towards things that you're naturally good at. So I think because that was my top sport, I just loved it. But then the sport, you know, it's such a beautiful sport, really. People think of it as this brute force, you know, power and all that. And yes, there is that element. But it's like a live chess game. I mean, there's so many facets to it to make it. Yeah, it's really interesting to pit the, you know, you got to get the matchups and you got to read the defense. Then you have to, you know, match the offense to what they're giving you. There's so much more to it that I really enjoyed.
You weren't able to play Pee Wee ball, correct?
Correct.
So
still mad.
It's evidence. You hide it well, though. It comes out in other forms, I imagine. But how did you get around that?
You mean not
to play as a youth?
Well, I didn't. I didn't play organized ball as a youth.
So that was your workaround.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And it just, you know, it would upset me so because all my friends, the boys, were going off and divided into these great little teams with their uniforms and this and that. And I couldn't go. So, yeah, I guess it did propel me into making it happen later in life.
So I imagine you got these lads together in the fields and the backyards, et cetera, ended scrimmage, you know, informally. How did you pair against them?
I was as good as they were.
Excellent.
I mean, to be honest, I really was. I could catch better. I could outrun them. I think every single one of them I could outrun. I had an arm that was equal to theirs. Which made it even harder to understand, why can't I play? And they even wanted me to play. It wasn't like they were keeping me out. It was just, you know, societal norms of that day, which are slowly changing, thank goodness. But it was just a tough message to digest. I didn't like it at all.
I mean, growing up in Florida, obviously that's the South. It could have been a little bit more sexist back then. But then again, when you apply it to football, there's still a lot of sexism, and we'll get to that later in a few minutes. That still is a light veil over the NFL and a lot of different workplaces. But did you feel any different when you were attending FSU, when you were playing rugby or a semi-pro golf, that there was a difference between the way men and women were treated on and off the field or court?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No question about it. I mean, even in our intramural games at FSU, the guys always got the good fields. You know, we were always put off to the more worn fields or the smaller ones, certainly not center stage. In rugby, I felt like it was pretty equal. There was such a camaraderie between the men's rugby team and the women's rugby team.
Interesting.
That it was almost blended. Yeah, it was really great. We had such fun and supported each other.
Why do you think that sports, existed in rugby and not other sports?
Probably the beer.
You're right. The post-rugby après parties.
Yeah. Right, right. It was just such a family event, you know, quote unquote family. Everyone just got along. We all took off from the pitch after the game and indulged in a keg. So I think that was probably one of the reasons. But we practiced together, too. We did a lot of practicing, we pitted, you know, one against the other, and that helped us get better. And also we became friends. So it was a lot of fun.
So when you played rugby, was that a big release for you? Because it's obviously very similar, very different, but also similar to football in nature.
Right. You're right. It is similar in that it's contact. you know, it is different because in theory, in rugby, you shouldn't get tackled. You know, you should get rid of the ball before you get, you know, pounded. But I loved it. It was it's a great game. I really enjoyed it. But I did play it because there was no football. And then once intramural came along, I could play on the intramural flag football. Eventually, I did that instead.
A bit of a sidebar here, but I always felt that rugby, I never played rugby, never was in the area where I attended school, but I always thought that rugby players are probably tougher than football players because they don't have the obvious thing, pads.
Right, right. They are tough. If you go off, if you get injured in a rugby game and you go off the field, you don't come back. I mean, it's, you know, you just play with 14, you know, instead of your full team. So it's encouraged. Yeah, it's encouraged. You know, there's no timeouts for injury. There's no, I mean, if you're really injured.
Sure. Course, well, but, hence the bloody stumps on the field.
Exactly. Right.
So I've always wondered about that. So you came to New York City in 1983, not for football, for a career in art, correct?
That's correct.
Tell me about that. You went to Pratt?
I went to Pratt, which was a great experience. I got my master's there, and I moved to New York City sight unseen. It was the most incredible journey. I still get chills. I've been there over 30 years, and I still get chills when the plane lands. You know, I fly in and see the city, and I'm like, ooh, I'm home. It's like on a vacation.
By the way, I am disenchanted with you that you're not in studio today, but I wanted to speak to you so badly. I forwent having you in studio because you live here.
I do. I love New York City.
So you owe me one.
I appreciate that, Mark.
You got it.
I really do.
So continue, yeah. Please.
Well, yes, I went to Pratt and, I got my master's there in commercial design. My first job was at Cosmopolitan Magazine, and this was back when Helen Gurley Brown was the editor. She was a fascinating, wonderful person.
That's a phenomenal launching point, Cosmo.
Yes, I was so pleased. Well, oddly enough, though, I met the art director in a gym.
Of course.
So, you know, I was, of course, you know, it all tied in.
One arm pull-ups.
Well, yeah.
So what was your position at Cosmo, and what in terms of the art department, what exactly were you doing?
Oh, I was just an assistant there. I was still in school, and back then we did paste-up for the magazine. Can you believe it? My gosh, I'm certainly dating myself. But I did a lot of paste-up, and occasionally I'd get to do some design, but mostly it was paste-up and prep for production.
Fascinating. And then I guess fast forward a touch, your next job after that?
I worked for Norman Lear for several of his magazines that he produced. He had some technical business magazines, and I became art director for a couple of them. And that was, that was in the late 80s.
How did you develop an eye for that? Is that something that just kind of you think was innate?
Well, I think design, I think you do have an eye for design one way or the other. Mm. And then, of course, going to Pratt and
honing it
incredible.
In.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do think you have an eye for it, though. And I love design. I love color, anything like that. I love interior design just as well. My place in New York, it's like a giant canvas to me. I love decorating and doing things like that. And then I ended up at Atlantic Records and worked my way up to vice president, creative director.
That is phenomenal.
The division.
So you were doing album covers, artwork for them?
We did album covers, and then we broke off into a division that did CDs and VHS for the fitness industry.
How fun was that?
Oh my God, it was so much fun!
Yeah.
I did all these. I did all the art, the photo shoots. A lot of them were in LA, so I got to travel to LA a lot.
So now it's coming full circle into your love of fitness.
Yes.
Wow, yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. And so you heard about a, for sake of time, unfortunately, you have a great compelling story, but it is radio. We do have a lengthy period of time, but I want to get everything in here. You went to Fire Island to do what one weekend?
I heard they had a flag football group that was playing, and sure enough, I found them. Or they found me, I should say. I was sitting there holding onto my football like a security blanket, and and they found me, and the rest is history. I became a player on their team, got involved with their league. One day, many, many years later, we got a call from these guys that were forming a professional football league, Tackle, which all of us, our eyes bugged out, like, what? Let's do this. I ended up owning the team simply because no one else purchased it. It was not anything I ever dreamed of or wanted to do. I did it so we could play. And
was it in financial ruins at that time, in jeopardy of being just obliterated?
No, actually, it was just starting.
Oh, it was just starting. Oh, that particular team, though.
Oh, the team was the team was great.
Oh, it was Sharks, okay, great.
The flag team, yeah, they were, but we were all flag teams. So when this started up, you had to have an owner, quote unquote.
Sure.
And so someone had to fork over the money to buy the franchise. And when no one else did, I was like, oh, here we go again. I'm not going to get to play. So I was in a position where I could take money out of my savings, and I purchased the franchise, and
thank God for corporate work, right?
Yes, that's right. God for art.
It's amazing how one foothold opened up this incredible door for a dream you've had for a lifelong time. I mean, not that you thought about being a pro football player or even owning a team, but the fruition of how your dream just came to surface is remarkable.
It's divine intervention. Mm. I know. I'm certain. It's been a wonderful ride and story.
And it gets even better than that. You were the quarterback for the first few seasons.
I was, yeah.
So tell me about how you were so skilled, your acumen to be a quarterback by playing flag football for years, that you didn't have any problem transitioning. And it's just, that's something, because a quarterback is, from what I know about football, is a fair amount, but it's not something that you can kind of groom someone for. You kind of have it in you.
You're right. It does take a mindset. And you're right also with the flag. I mean, I had been playing quarterback for flag for so long. Now, it was a transition because now it's 11 on 11 and it's tackle. So the reads are a lot different. You have to learn so much about the game.
Pressure.
You have to understand defenses. You have to pressure. The decision-making is so important. Unfortunately for me, I was already 40 years old when I bought the team. So, my athleticism was kind of fading by the time I got there. But still, it was just an incredible experience. Did I wish it had come along 10 years earlier? Oh, yeah. But I still got out there and did what I could and had lived the story of my life.
Well, obviously, you have a pretty impressive physical prowess. How tall are you, Andrea?
I'm 5'8".
All right. Good size?
Yeah, it's decent size. I've never been very big, though, Mark. So my arm was not one of the strongest. I can knock you over at 20 yards, but, the long bombs they weren't as long as some of the other quarterbacks in the league.
So you got out of the pocket a lot, I imagine.
I ran a lot.
Good for
I was
you.
Quick.
Andrea Douglas is my guest today. She's the author of Black and Blue, Sports, Love, and the Art of Empowerment. My name is Mark Farrell. This is Progressive Radio Network. This is Insight Thursday morning. Andrea owned an incredible New York Sharks pro football team for 20 years. You must have. Was it hard to make the decision to step away from the position as quarterback and just to solely focus on being the team owner?
Not really, Mark. By then, whenever I would play, I started to see the ground coming at me. I was like, "Oh, this is going to hurt." So it was time, and I knew that. And there was so many things to do behind the scenes. I never lacked for anything to do, so it wasn't so hard. I miss it, but, you know, missing and playing are two different things.
Absolutely. What kind of toll did it take on your body, if any?
Again, I was lucky because I only played for the several years, and I never really had any serious injuries, which, you know, more divine intervention, I guess.
And this is no surprise. You've had many firsts, Andra. Featured in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, outstanding, out in Canton, Ohio. First to have a retired jersey on permanent display at the Sports Museum of America. First women's team to play a televised halftime scrimmage during an NFL game. And first to ever host an NFL junior player development program for girls at the NFL practice facility. I mean, those are some incredible feats that you maintained and achieved. That's so kudos to you, my friend.
Thank you so much, Mark. Appreciate that.
Do those accolades mean anything to you? Or is it just the fact that you were just playing and living your dream?
Well, I guess that's why they mean everything, because you know, follow your heart and everything else follows you. And it has become, you know, I wanted to play just because it was my dream, but it has become clear, it has become clear that this team and this league has helped so many individuals. It's so much bigger than football. So because my dream led me to that, it means a lot because I've been able to help others in many ways.
Very true. And all the skills, Andra, that you had off the field, I imagine are very transferable. Being a manager, being a leader, dealing with personalities. I can't imagine the various personalities, because the average person, you know, especially a line person, I almost said lineman, right? Line person.
That's okay.
You know, what drives them to just be the grunt and the nit and gritty of the team? And just, so I imagine you get people coming from all walks of life for all reasons, obviously because I love football, but I imagine that would be a handful right there.
You know, it is a handful. It's a huge handful, but it's a good handful because football is one of the few sports. There are so many people. There's 45 people on a team.
Wow.
And to make all those buttons click, it's magic. It's absolutely magic. And every single person is so important. So, you know, managing all those people, it was a handful, yes, but it was also a joy because I've met the most wonderful people that have come through for so many reasons. And, it was difficult at times, but also very, very rewarding.
Well, also must have served you quite well to be not only just the owner, but a player. I mean, you obviously were playing with most of the players, I imagine, as you rose up, as you were concurrently holding both titles. But that says a lot. I mean, to be able to walk the walk, you know, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And you know the power of camaraderie and the power of fraternal organizations, even going back to when you were a kid and your father and you belonged to a hunting organization or a camp. And unfortunately, your father was called in for a meeting because he was told that the fact that he was bringing his daughter in, you, Andra Douglas, the other members weren't allowed or happy with this. And so your father stood up and said, "That's it, I quit." And I guess a few of his buddies followed suit. So that just speaks volumes, I think, about who you are innately in your DNA in terms of being a leader, not listening to people's direction and cutting your own trail and blazing your own path, I should say.
I had, both of my parents were incredible. And that story about my dad is one of my favorite ever because hunting was all he was. I mean, he was just 100% woodsman. So for him to stand up and say, "Hey, if I can't bring her, then I'm quitting," that just, what he was willing to give up was amazing. So, I think I got a lot of strength from him and my mom as well. They're amazing people.
And, you know, there's so many things that we experience in life that may or may not be on the pages, because obviously this is a reflection of your life, this book, Black and Blue, that's so eloquently written. But I imagine in a macro sense, it sounds like, though, you didn't have to, and I could be well off on this, Andra, you didn't have to forfeit a lot to get what you wanted. You got to really get your feet wet in the art world. You got your master's. You worked for some incredible, groundbreaking organizations. And then voila, one thing led to another. Played flag football, opened up or became part of the New York Sharks, owned the team for 20 years. And the last season was like a story tale. I mean, the accolades and the season that you won. And I believe that's going to be the premise of book number two. But it just seemed to all really work out.
It is. Disney couldn't have made this story up, Mark.
Thank
my
God.
Whole life, I'm just, yeah. I am just so blessed on every level, and my life is a story. You know, it's just a good, happy story in the end. Of course, you go through things. I went through depression. I went through pain of loss, rejection, all that stuff. But overall, my life has been a journey that I wouldn't trade a day for anything.
Well, we all have dark days. And when we have you in the studio for a proper full-length interview, I'll share my days as well, because we speak about mental health a lot on this program. And I'm a staunch advocate for persons with disabilities, and that runs the gamut. But very quickly, I'd like to mention, because obviously you're a New Yorker for 30 years, we are in New York City, and in 2010, New York City declared August 9th, 2010, to be New York City Sharks Day. How cool is that?
That's right. Way cool.
Yeah, and also you're the founder of Fins Up, Foundation for Female Athletes, a nonprofit to benefit at-risk teens. Again, kudos to you for all your work. I'm really, really have enjoyed reading. I'm not all the way through your book, but it is just so well written. It's about a part of athletics and sport that needs to be told, needs to be embraced. And it's interesting how sports in general, I think the reason why women's sports haven't risen to the tide where they should is because nostalgia. I think people are just so used to seeing men dominate sports, but I think the tide is changing, and no better time, especially when you read this book, Black and Blue, Sports, Love, and the Art of Empowerment. You are an incredible trailblazer. You are a juggernaut, Andrew Douglas.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I so appreciate the time, and I really would love to come into the studio when I get back.
Yes, please do. And by the way, what's your website address so people can enjoy your incredible art that I was thoroughly entranced by?
It's AndraDouglasArt.com.
Andrew
Douglas. You can also buy the book there, and you can buy the book on Amazon. And if you check out the New York Sharks page, we have some great little tidbits there all about the players and the history and all of that.
Excellent. Andrew Douglas,
and
all the pleasure.
Football.
Yeah, exactly. Andrew Douglas, all the best to you. And when you come in the studio, I'm going to find out your favorite play to call when you're a quarterback.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, Black and Blue is her new book, Sports, Love, and the Art of Empowerment. Andrew Douglas, all the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. Insight will be right back after this.
Talk with Mark now. Call 888-874-4888. Insight on the Progressive Radio Network.
Resilience comes in so many different forms. When we think about people who are resilient, you think about someone who is on an Oprah show or something you saw in your news feed on social media. And that's true. And I'm not discounting it, because everyone comes from a different background. Everyone has different experiences. Some are worse. And I don't think when you say or compare experiences that one is really worse, because to that person who experiences something that's painful, could be for a short period or an extended period, pain is pain. And I don't think you can really compare that. So today I'm privileged to introduce a guest who I met through a former guest on this show. And we connected over another a commonality, the great outdoors. And we got to speaking about what makes her tick in life and her past experiences. And she knows about my parents' past experiences, as all PRN listeners know to the show on Insight, in terms of all my debaucherous lifestyles, losing a brother to suicide, my experience with depression and anxiety, the whole boatload, the whole kit and caboodle. So when I was speaking to Tara Pace, my guest today, I learned that she had a very unsettling background, a very limited childhood. And we're going to get into this and meet Tara, because she's a miraculous person that has overcome much. And like everybody, every day is overcoming something new. and has everything compartmentalized because we can't always figure things out. We learn enough to deal and to cope so we can put one foot in front of each other day by day and be a mother, be a father, be a sibling, be a parent. And then we focus on these issues and try to make the best out of life as we see fit. Welcome to the show, Tara Pace.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So your childhood started off not that colorful.
Very dark.
Very dark. You had parents who were in the drug world, drug dealers, drug users.
Yes.
So a woman, a five-year-old who is in a mostly African-American neighborhood was kind of sheltered because of your safety, and they probably knew a lot of people who weren't that friendly, as we can imagine.
Right.
And you weren't allowed to go too many places, and a lot of income was not coming in and flooding in the doors. And tell us about how sometimes your meals were resorted to, what you did for nutrition.
Oh, well, meals in my house are pretty bleak. It was basically dog food. The dogs had plenty of food because my parents were drug dealers. They, back in the 70s, having big dogs was the alarm system. So we had Doberman Pinschers. We had many of them, and they were my brothers and my sisters. They were my life, those dogs. And they ate the dog food, so I ate the dog food.
Because you were hungry and no other option.
Because I opened their fridge and the only thing in there was curdled milk. My parents would be so high for so many days that food was not important. It was not even a thought to them.
Were there any adults, family members, extended family members, or even clients, people who would come in to buy drugs that would see possibly that? Now, I can't characterize people who use drugs, because I used to use drugs, as being people who are ill-willed, bad intention, because a lot of people are very functioning and listening to this interview who use drugs as a recreational way of living. So, but did anyone ever say, wow, you know, your daughter or your son or your kids need something to eat, or can I help out, or any comments or questions made?
Yeah, I think over the years, you know, I had great grandparents that happened to live across the street, because, you know, my family is very poor, and that was where my very old great grandparents could afford to live. So they would come over occasionally, and they would bring over some food for me. And as the years went on, they were bringing more food, and I was maybe visiting them a little bit more than I normally would. But I was very, very sheltered. My parents pretty much made sure that I didn't go out of the house. They, in fact, locked me into it with double locks. When they would go out to sell the drugs, they would just lock me inside, so I couldn't actually get out of the house.
Now, as children, we don't know any better. We don't have any way to compare things, because maybe when you went to school, and we'll get to that in a moment, but you would speak to your peers and other students, etc. But did you know something was askew? And if you did, at what age did you start realizing, you know what, this isn't your typical nuclear family?
No, well, first I want to clarify by saying that I did not speak to my peers. I was socially so unprepared for the world outside of my own home that when I would go out there, I literally did not know how to even communicate with people. No interaction. I didn't even take a school bus. I was just, my parents didn't even wake up. They would just tell me to take money out of their purse or their wallet for a taxi. So I was taking a taxi to kindergarten.
In Seattle?
In the state of Washington. With no food, no backpack. Just show up, and then I would go to class because that's what you're supposed to do. And as far as my parents were concerned, my mother doesn't have a high school diploma. I'm not sure that my father does. Education wasn't important to them. It wasn't even a topic in any of my family at all. Education has never been a focus in my family. So this was not important to them. They just wanted to make sure they didn't get into trouble.
That was the whole focus.
That was their whole focus. Yeah. You have to go, or we're going to get into trouble. It wasn't like you have to go because you need to get an education.
See. Sure, because we don't want any administrators or teachers coming contacting the law and knocking on our door, etc.
Right.
So with that said, were any red flags raised with your hygiene, the way you dressed, the way you were detached?
I was You know, at that age, I honestly, when you're that sheltered, and I'm sure there's some people out there that can relate to this, when you're that sheltered, you really don't, you're not at an age where you're comparing to other people. You're just in your skin. And then one day you wake up and a light bulb goes off and you realize, whoa, there's something really wrong here. This is not how other people live. What's going on here? And that light bulb for me went off at about 12. And when it went off, it burned bright for me. And it hit me like a wall, that everything that I had been going through for my entire childhood up until 12 was absolutely illegal and awful. And every bit of it was awful.
Was it one defining moment or experience at that age of 12?
Yeah. There was one defining moment, and it was very hard. My father throughout my childhood would sexually abuse me. I didn't know this, that was what he was doing. I just trusted him because he was my father. He was my daddy, and
absolutely,
I loved him,
sure.
And I never questioned it. I just felt like I was in my safe place.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got older, I got more and more uncomfortable with the word sex and being close to anybody else like that, because I did that with my dad. So this was a very weird moment for me to realize that you don't do that with your dad. And then it became such an issue that my mother actually held me down so that I would lose my virginity and watched. So she thought that she could just get that out of me by just letting somebody do it to me.
Do you think that she thought that this was maybe a rite of passage for her husband, your father, to have it in within the family? Well, let's transition now, because obviously with that statement made, it's clear that your mom has a lot of mental illness issues.
Yes, my mother has a lot of mental illness issues.
And to think that that's even plausible, conceivable for any adult to do or witness or for their child is obviously inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
So you have siblings, and I think recently you found out about more of siblings, but back then, how many siblings were actually under the same roof?
It was just me until my 13th birthday. It was just me. There was one other child that was born a year after me, and he died, unfortunately. And I always wonder how differently my life would have been had I had a brother, or at least a witness, or somebody to go through it with. God works in mysterious ways. I'm sure there's a reason why that he didn't make it. There's controversy in my family that the reason why the child didn't make it is because my parents were so high on drugs that they actually forgot they had another child. So that by the time they found the child was very, very blue.
Sounds very likely.
Yes.
And I imagine you probably have said to yourself, maybe my brother, what was his name? Did he have a name?
His name was Ernie.
Ernie. Maybe Ernie, and I hate saying these words, but maybe Ernie got the easy way out.
Ernie got the easy way out. But he's with me every day.
Good. I'm so sorry for what you've had to encounter.
It's been hard. I don't think that people understand that when you deal with that amount of fear for that long, over 20, 30 years of constant, everyday, crippling fear, that it absolutely destroys a person. And it has taken me 2 decades to be okay with all of that and just forgive it and let it go. But that
work.
Little girl still lives inside of me, which is why you're hearing the tears, because she's the one that's crying. I feel bad for her sometimes.
Was going to school sometimes something you looked forward to because it was an outlet, it was an escape?
Never looked forward to it. School was always awful for me.
Because that was a different form of awfulness.
It was just, I never could find... I was never smart enough. I was never comfortable with being called on. I couldn't, I couldn't put together the answer fast enough. I couldn't compute simple things. My body was so riddled with anxiety and fear and other human emotions that absolutely powered over anything else. Mm. As far as math was nothing compared to the beating that I was going to get at home at the end of my school day.
So you were physically abused as well.
I was physically abused. Like, that was all my head could think about. I mean, yes, I was safe while I was at school because I was not being abused in some form. But my head could never get out of that headspace because trying to concentrate on learning English, but my head is thinking, wow, I wonder what's going to happen to me today.
Sure, it's 3 o'clock. I have to go home and endure beating X, Y, or Z.
Right. All the other kids are looking at the clock thinking, when's recess? I'm looking at the clock thinking, how many more hours before I have to go back home?
There wasn't an adult counselor that ever picked up on anything or tried to befriend you to...
There were people, and I'm going to just say it here, and I hate to even say this. I really do, but... We had the police at our house so many times. I've probably called 911 100 times in my lifetime as a child. And dozens of times I begged them to take me with them. I begged them. And they didn't. And they failed me in the 70s. They failed us, the children of the 70s. I'm positive if that happened today, if a police officer came into a house that saw that there was drugs going on and clearly abuse with a
Absolutely.
Woman that's got a black eye and bruises all of her arms and a child that's begging to be taken out of the situation, that they would have taken me out. But they didn't. And every time that I got the nerve to beg the police to take me out, I told them that if they didn't take me, they were going to beat me. And every time the police left, they beat me. Because I opened up and I tried to get away.
Was running away and never coming back an option?
Running away and never coming back is what I did.
At what age?
At 15.
Wow. Talk about courage, Tara Pace. I mean, that's... The world is very big and scary and unknown, but I guess what you were enduring between those four walls, you know, bring it on outside world, I'll take it on.
Now I feel like I can do anything. Now I feel like I'm a woman. Hear me roar.
Mm.
And that is why I'm here today. For all of you women out there, for all of you men out there that are responsible for doing anything like this, even thinking it, don't think it. The repercussions of actions like this live in our DNA. It never goes away. 20, 30 years of crippling fear for one human being ripples throughout a family. It can destroy an entire family, that type of fear and abuse. It's not just me that went through that. It was a pastor, it was the police officers, it was the neighbors, it was the teachers, it was the grandparents, it was the mental institutions mm-hmm. that my mother was in for years and years and years, chained to beds. It was endless. It was just endless. It was all negative all the time, every minute of the day. It was unrelentless until I left. And even then, it wasn't over. Even when I left, my mother was threatening to kill me, calling the police on me, telling them that I was a runaway.
So Tara, talk about that. Did you make a concrete decision on day X you're going to leave, or it just something happened, a beating or... intimacy, and you just said, this is it, and you flew the coop.
No, my mother made the decision because she didn't make any money, and she discovered from people constantly saying how beautiful her daughter was that I became kind of a lotto ticket, for lack of a better word. So she put me to work at the age of 13, and I was already making money to pay for the bills. Nobody else was working.
So as a model.
As a model in the area, Seattle at the time.
And there was a market for it back then?
There was a market for it. And, you know, I was making like, I don't know, $75 an hour. Maybe I'd work an hour or 2 hours. But for us, that was big money.
Hmm.
That was like, for as far as
Windfall,
my mother was
sure.
concerned, that was like, she'd hit
She'd hit the Mega Millions with me. So she put me to work. She pulled me out of school. It wasn't an option. I had to do it. I didn't want to do it, but
you
I
were
also
out of school full time,
home.
Or just
I was out of school full time.
And the administrators, no one followed up on this?
Nobody did.
Big holes in a system.
Big holes.
Gargantuan.
Gargantuan holes. They failed me. They failed this one.
And how much longer when you were 13? You said you were 15 when you actually left the house.
I finally left. I was scouted by a beautiful man that worked in New York City at the time and owned a modeling agency called Elite Model Management. He has since passed away. He was an incredible man, and he saved my life. And to this day, I say my prayers at night, and I thank him. If it wasn't for him, I would not be sitting here speaking with you today. He saw a child that needed more than just a fashion career. He saw a child that really needed a break. He scooped me up under his wings. There was nothing ever inappropriate about it. It was very fatherly. It's as if he knew what was happening. And he fixed everything.
You never disclosed to him?
I disclosed everything to him.
You did?
I did.
Immediately or over time?
Immediately. I mean, I was so broken when I first came. I mean, in order to even just go meet a client, they had to teach me what to do, how to hold a conversation, to put out my hand and shake the person's hand when I walk in the room.
You had no socialization skills.
I had no social skills whatsoever. It was very difficult. And then to be thrown into a world of fashion where you're living under such a microscope was just so much pressure for me. It was terrifying. I spent every night crying. I hated it. I didn't even want to be a model, but I didn't want to go home either.
But it's a different form of being under the microscope of you weren't going to be beaten or abused physically or sexually, but now you're under the microscope, so now you have to act like you're living in a perfect world.
Right, and now I have to act like Mrs. Sunshine, and I have to just tuck all of those emotions down deep and try to focus on this new aspect of my life that this person is trying to help me do. And he was really wonderful. And again, I'm going to be 48 soon, and I'm sitting here today, so it clearly all worked out.
Sure.
But my mother did everything that she could to ruin that relationship. As she's trying to get me into the business, she's also threatening to pull me out. She always reminded me that I was only one airplane away and that she would come and just kill me if she wanted to.
And I imagine those words still reverberate.
And I believed every word of it. Yeah. I mean, she called the police on me here in New York City and tell them I was a runaway.
Were you giving them money after you left the house?
I gave them all
my
money.
You still gave them money and they were still threatening you.
And yes, I was giving. That was the deal with the man that brought me to New York.
Otherwise, they would probably have called the cops. And the cops probably would have done their job then.
Absolutely. So we had to pay my mother a certain amount of money for her to just leave me alone. So I was paying off my mother.
For how many years did this go on?
This went on until I was 19, until I got a tax lien. I didn't know people paid taxes. I'd never even heard the word taxes before. I didn't know people paid taxes.
No, drug dealers don't pay taxes. And there's no sales tax on that ounce of marijuana you just sold mom and dad either, is there?
No.
No receipt.
So I had a delicious tax lien at the age of 19 for over $13,000. And for me, that might as well have been $13 million.
Of course.
It was a number that I just thought, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to pay this off, ever. At that time, I was living off of $20 a week. I was given a $20 bill every Monday, and I had to make that last until the next Monday. And all the rest of the money went home to my family.
That's your choice, the $20, or that's what
that
they demanded?
That was my agent's choice. He was trying to teach me how to survive, how to be smart with my money.
Sure.
He was giving me parenting skills already at that age.
Great.
Mind you, this was the late 80s
sure.
in New York City when riding the subway was...
Yeah, 50 cents.
I don't even remember anymore. They were tokens. I remember that. And if you bought a bunch of them, you even got a deal.
So were there days, though, Tara Pace, that you could actually just go,
today.
But never back then, even though you weren't under the roof, you just knew their tentacles were nearby.
Oh, I knew. I knew that she would have shown up at my door at any moment. I feared it.
Do you think she would be even, I'm not trying to discredit your mom more than necessary, but if I do, I'm sorry. Do you think she'd even be brave enough to get on a plane? Doesn't seem like she ventured too far out of her.
No, I think she was all talk. Yeah. I think she was. But, you know, I had witnessed her physical abilities in person, and I know what she's capable of. I know she could have beat
so
me
that
to
alone
that
is
just
a threat
the fear
enough.
Of her, just her threatening me over the phone had me shaking, for sure.
Tara Pace is my guest. This is Insight. The show is on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Let's talk about how you became a teenager, when you started to pull a little bit further away from your family. I'm sure you discovered boys, and people can be nice. There's actually a safe world out there. And share, if you can, and if you're comfortable doing so, when you started to feel maybe you were falling in love with someone and how that played out.
Yeah, that was unexpected, for sure. I did meet a nice young man in the late 80s, and we dated for a couple years, and I moved in with him, and it was really lovely, but it was definitely a learning curve for me, just learning how to respect another person and be respected in a safe zone, a safe place, and not just sexual. This is just basic human kindness, holding open a door for somebody or
respect.
Making dinner for them because they're working late, or just holding hands. Simple thing, holding hands felt so intimate to me in itself that was enough.
And comforting.
Very comforting. It was like having a blanket. I mean, even today, I have no idea. I literally have no idea what it feels like to be hugged by your own parent and genuinely feel safe in their arms. I don't know what that feels like. I envy people, my girlfriends, when I see them with their mothers going out to lunch, and you can tell everything's bubbly and wonderful and there's love and they feel safe. But I didn't have that, and that took me a while to figure out how to do that in relationships. And every relationship that I've been in, and there hasn't been many because I'm kind of a monogamous, long-term relationship type of person. I find somebody I love, and I work through issues.
Well, that is excellent to hear, because I would imagine it'd be very likely for someone who experienced what you did to be in serial relationships, because you couldn't commit. You wouldn't want to commit. You have no idea what commitment is, et cetera. And when we talked about resilience in the beginning of the show, I think many of us in this world always kind of give ourselves the short end of the stick. We don't take stock of what we've done and accomplished in life. And I'm not talking about professionally. I'm just talking about your milestones in life. And Tara Pace, I think you really have to be cognizant of the fact that what you're able to do with your life, I mean, how courageous and brave, how you didn't become an alcoholic, die of drug overdose, anything to kill the pain, with all the experiences that were just sometimes demented that happened to you, that you have a very healthy marriage, you have a 3-year-old boy, you have your hands at a lot of different pies in organizations that are part of your DNA, that allow you to breathe and allow your family to grow in and outside the house. So I hope you take stock of how indelible and how magnificent your life has become. Not shortchanging by any means, or how much work it's involved and how many tears have been spilled. And we haven't even gotten to your medical condition, dystonia. Your neuromuscular disorder, which is affects your neck.
Yes.
Which
cervical.
Well,
dystonia.
How is the show otherwise, Mrs. Lincoln? You know, we don't have that much time, but this is another impediment in your life.
Yes.
That hasn't stopped you from being Tara Pace and doing what you want to do. My mantra in life is my difference makes me stronger. And that you can own that.
I own that as well. I absolutely own it. I definitely feel like at this point in my life, there's nothing I can't do. I know.
You're Kevlar.
I can do anything now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have done all of the hardest human emotions, and I've done them for a long term, and I have been tested. I did a home birth for my son without medications or help because I wanted to feel the pain. I wanted to be present. I wanted to do it on my own. I did it successfully. It was the most beautiful thing I ever did with my life. And I'm very proud of myself. It's been a hard, long road, but it has been a fulfilling road. And I feel like that I have a lot to share with other people, and I can help other people. And I feel like that's a part of my purpose.
Absolutely. And I love how you succinctly put it before about how there are so many different components that were in your DNA. But there are, in my perspective, there are two different aspects to this. There is an end. There's a final chapter in you. All that badness stopped that spilled into you from your mom, your dad, and anyone else who was just not a very good influence. And then you have just turned that all around to be the incredible parent, the woman who succeeded for 30 years in the fashion industry, who is has a marvelous son, who is the parent that you were never experienced. Now you can be that parent.
That,
you're not allowing any of that to spill over into your life.
I'm not.
It propels you now.
I am the antithesis of everything that I have gone through. I shine bright like a light in my house, and I shine that light on everybody that I come across. I always leave people better than I found them. That's part of my heartbeat. That makes me feel good. I want to help people. I don't want anybody to feel like I've ever felt, ever. And I want to leave them better than I found them.
Yeah, and I think you're doing just that. I'm very, very proud of you.
Thank you so much.
I'm really happy to know you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a long journey, and it doesn't get easier.
No.
But it gets more familiar.
It does.
And you get better at it.
Thank you.
You know, you do.
Thank you.
And again, you can handle anything in life, all the things that you've overcome, anything that comes your way, in a family matter, or even just as a shoulder for your friends and maybe colleagues. It's just a wonderful thing to not experience those bad things, but it does, the silver lining does have a plus to life sometimes.
Even with the dystonia, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, I can deal with it. I'm way more entertaining to look at now because my head's just dancing around all the time, but I'm okay with it.
I never would have noticed that you had dystonia. Never
really?
Would notice. No.
Everybody says I'm really good at covering it up because, you know, I move my head, make it look like I'm doing something. I'll touch my chin.
We all are the best actors.
Yes, we are.
And we can all do awards, but we are who we are, and we should love that aspect of us. Tara Pace, continue to be the resilient, indomitable force that you are.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for sharing this really, really personal side of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Special thanks to Tara Pace and to Andrew Douglas, two incredible women that know no bounds. Mark Farrell right here. Insight will be back next week. Gary Knowles next. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Insight with Mark Farrell. Check out this and all Insight shows on the Insight page at PRN.FM. PRN.FM. Have Mark speak at your company, your kid's school or college. Mark speaks on critical topics that affect kids and adults everywhere, from anti-bullying, mental health, drugs, and alcohol to overcoming adversity. Visit MarkFarrellMotivation.com for more info. Insight, Thursday mornings at 11 on the Progressive Radio Network.